This is the son of PCJ. Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up, South Korea and Japan sign a military cooperation agreement. Will the easing of sanctions against Burma affect its historical buildings? Microbreweries in Asia are taking off and catching up with beer fans the world over. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. South Korea and Japan will meet next month to consider the signing of a historic military cooperation agreement, the first of its kind between the two nations. It would also represent a milestone since Japan's colonial rule over Korea ended in 1945. The aim is to share intelligence on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, but Seoul and Tokyo deny their talks have been affected by North Korea's latest rocket test. Karen Snowden has more.
Defense spokesmen in both South Korea and Japan have told the media there that North Korea's recent attempt to fire a test rocket has not brought forward the timetable for talks. The neighbors have been in talks over very limited military cooperation for more than 2 years. The aim is to share intelligence on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and allow for joint peacekeeping and sea search and rescue operations. Matthias Maas, assistant professor in international relations at Yonsei University, says even a limited security agreement would be significant and make sense.
South Korea and Japan, given the overall layout of Northeast Asian security, seem to be logical partners. And it always struck me as odd why they haven't really been able to cooperate more closely in security matters. Certainly is some cooperation, not the least through the six-party talks.
Despite any common sense in such an agreement, the South Korean government would face opposition to it from some citizens for reasons of Japan's colonization of Korea, often with brutal effect for the first half of the 20th century. That's the view of Dr. Baek Si-young-joo from the Korean Institute of Defense Analyses, who says there's still no deadline for signing.
Most important is that South Korea has discussed these issues for more than 2 years. But the South Korea government did not conclude to make agreement.
In addition, Dr. Baek says China and North Korea would view a bilateral agreement as enhancing the alliance with the U.S.
Yes, China is very nervous.
Matthias Maas agrees.
In many ways, the more these trilateral groups, South Korea and Japan and the U.S., integrate and cooperate, the more for China that smacks like containment of a rising power, that feels then more like these are trying to limit the rise of China. So I think there will be some criticism, but in many ways at this level it's hard to openly picture this as an aggressive move.
So on the whole, you see it as positive for regional politics in the Northeast Asia region? A step forward in a way, at least bilaterally, I suppose?
Well, I think actually bilaterally that's something positive, something that, you know, over the long term maybe these two countries can build on, and that might help them overcome their historical problems and the territorial disputes, etc., etc. Regional, I also see that if Japan and South Korea can align their outlooks, their policies, their security arrangements more, that might be helpful in terms of managing particularly the North Korean security and nuclear problem.
Regional tensions have been higher since Kim Jong-un succeeded his late father, Kim Jong-il, who died last year. Hopes that the succession would result in a softening in Pyongyang's belligerence have been dashed with continued threats against Seoul and suspected preparations for a possible nuclear test.
I think there was this moment where South Korea, where the U.S., Japan wanted to see if this new leadership would be more interested in really serious negotiations about denuclearization. And that, I think, has in many ways been disappointed or certainly been stalled. So I think then the response to refocus on more containment issues instead of engagement seems to be the name of the game right now.
With the easing of sanctions on Burma comes a concern that the unique build heritage of the country, in effect preserved by years of isolation, will be lost if something's not done to protect it. In particular, historians, architects, and planners are working together to develop a plan to preserve the unique streetscape of the city of Rangoon, once said to be the wealthiest city in Asia. For the moment, many of the grand buildings of the era of the British Raj are still standing, but they're at risk of being bulldozed by developers set to enter the newly opened country. Zoe Daniel has the story.
Desperately poor and crumbling it may be, but there's no hiding Rangoon's former glory. Boomtime buildings from the early 1900s still stand, frozen out of global progress by repression. In their shadow, I take a walk with Burma's leading historian, Thantmint Oo, who's the driver of the new Yangon Heritage Trust. He leads me on a journey back in time to the days when Burma was a global trading hub under British control.
I think it would have looked very much like an Indian city at the time, because the population would have been overwhelmingly Indian, but from a whole mix of different Indian communities, Pathans, Tamils, Bengalis, Gujaratis, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs. And then you would have had a sizable both European, mainly British, mainly Scottish population, and also a lot of people of mixed descent. I mean, there was many more Eurasians in Burma than in any other part of the British Empire. And the Burmese would have been a very clear minority.
Burma's population remains extraordinarily diverse. And in Rangoon, the cityscape hasn't changed much either, with a style reminiscent of Victorian Glasgow. It's one of the few positive side effects of years of isolation and lack of development, and there's a real push on to preserve it.
Well, this area used to be the commercial and the financial heart of British Burma. It's right in the middle of Rangoon. You have Chinatown and the Muslim Quarter off to one side, and then you have the docks area off to the other. It's also, in a way, a religious centre as well. You have a couple of pagodas, you have over a dozen cathedrals and churches, you have a Jewish synagogue, you have an Armenian church, you have about a dozen Sunni and Shia mosques. So it's a very, very cosmopolitan place in the early 20th century. And it's a place that, to some extent, has been almost perfectly preserved for over 50 years.
While there's plenty left that's worth keeping, it's estimated that about half of the city's heritage buildings have already been lost to the wrecking ball. With sanctions now being eased, there's only a short window of opportunity to draft preservation guidelines before an influx of money leads to insensitive development. Up an old lift, I visit UN Habitat, newly set up in one of Rangoon's classic buildings. It's supporting the local push. Spokesman Mike Slingsby.
Yes, indeed. No, it's a wonderful opportunity. The chances are here to preserve what is here before ad hoc development has taken place, and to avoid the sort of mistakes that Singapore did and let all the shop houses be demolished and then just end up with a few streets that are preserved in a rather artificial way. There's a chance here to keep the whole fabric of the inner city preserved.
The building styles are diverse. And while many were built in the colonial era, a highly fraught period of Burmese history, Chaw Kalia from the country's Architects Association says it's a time that should be remembered.
I have to say that, you know, it is part of our history. We cannot erase them. We all have to accept that it is part of our history and it is the link between our past and our future. So these buildings are important in our history as well because we've been colony for 100 years.
Burma's president has agreed to a temporary moratorium on the demolition of buildings, while the Yangon Heritage Trust puts together a plan which it'll present to the government in June. New guidelines will aim to regulate renovation as well as sales so that private houses are saved as well as government landmarks. Historian Thantmint Oo.
What would be great is if we could keep the overall sort of cityscape. I mean, the fact that you have people from so many different cultural backgrounds and religions living within a square mile, and you have so many other aspects of the old city that are still around. So rather than just sort of keeping a few big buildings as sort of tourist attractions, if we can preserve as much of this cosmopolitan heart of the city as possible, I think that would be a very useful, not just a useful thing economically and perhaps in terms of tourist drawing in tourists in the future, but also an important thing for this country as a multi-ethnic country going forward as well.
It's hard to fathom what Rangoon's buildings have seen as they've stood through a century of war, dictatorship and sheer neglect. Those fighting for them now want to make sure they see progress and a place in the country's future.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. The tendency of many Asian kids to spend their days inside is leading to short-sightedness, according to a recent study. Take Singapore, for example, where the average primary school pupil spends about 30 minutes outdoors every day. And as a result, up to 9 in 10 young adults are myopic. That compares with about 10% of myopic in children from European backgrounds in Australia, where kids spend on average 3 hours outside. Liam Cochran speaks to Professor Ian Morgan from the Australian National University College of Medicine, Biology and Environment.
Well, the link we think now is pretty clear. This was first discovered maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And that basically, children who spent more time outside were less likely to become myopic.
Why is that? What's the scientific processes there?
Well, the scientific process is now, I think, very clear. It's been quite a rapid progress. We think it's due to the fact that when you're outside, during daylight hours, of course, the light is a lot brighter than inside. Yeah, sometimes by as much as 100 times. We know that brighter light induces the release of dopamine from the retina, and we know that dopamine can actually block the elongation of the eye. And since the elongation of the eye is the structural basis of myopia, you've got a sort of very logical link. It's been confirmed in animal experimentation. If you put experimental animals into situations where they would become myopic and you repeat that experiment, but in the presence of bright light, you stop them becoming myopic. So we think we've got a pretty clear understanding of the mechanism.
So applying that to humans, I mean, increasingly these days, lots of young kids and children are spending a lot of time indoors. Why are we talking specifically about Asian children?
Well, because we think that we don't think it's specific to Asian or, in this case, specifically East Asian children, because we don't see the same level of myopia in India, for example, as we see in China. We think it's because the East Asian cultures have combined two things that lead to high levels of myopia. The first is a really major emphasis on educational success. Traditionally in Confucian societies, education has been the pathway into the Mandarin class and to social success. And they've coupled that with a lifestyle that does not emphasise in the way that, for example, Australian lifestyles emphasise spending time outside in sort of outside activities.
So can we partly at least blame this on the so-called tiger mum phenomenon?
Well, yeah, I have been quoted once as saying that what Asia needs is more hockey mums and less tiger mums. Yes, it is that massive emphasis on educational success, which is part of it, and part of the price that kids pay for that is they end up spending very little time inside. Now, it differs from, little time outside. It differs from place to place. In Singapore, what basically happens is the children go to school early. They're often going to school in the dark. They come home in the early afternoon, but then they just stay inside. They do not go outside until they become teenagers and start to hang out with their mates. But by then they're already myopic, so in a sense it doesn't matter.
What about the effect of the activities that they're doing while they're staying inside? The increased exposure to TV screens, computer screens, tiny little script on mobile phone screens. Is this contributing or is this a separate aspect?
No, there's no evidence that suggests that any of those factors are important, apart from the fact that they may be the reason why children are not getting outside. In other words, yeah, there's no correlation between the amount of time that a child spends on, yeah, computer games or playing, yeah, games on their mobile phone. But there is a strong correlation between the prevention of myopia and the amount of time they spend outside.
And the study also mentions the practice of having a nap at lunchtime, which is common across many different cultures in Asia, as well as South America, the sort of siesta culture. How does that play into this short-sighted issue?
Well, it's essentially the same thing. If you're, let's take the case of Guangzhou, where I do a fair amount of research. In Guangzhou, children have a 2.5-hour lunch break once they start school. Some of the children, roughly half the children in Guangzhou, will go home. They're sufficiently close that they can walk home. They go home, they have lunch, and then they'll probably sleep for 2 hours. Those that stay at school will obviously not go home, but they will have 40 minutes to eat their lunch, and then they'll sleep for approximately 2 hours in a darkened room. And it's a very different pattern of activity for children to the situation in Australian schools, where generally in the first year of school people try to get the children to take a nap, but it doesn't last more than a few months and then they're outside playing.
That was Professor Ian Morgan of the Australian National University's College of Medicine, Biology and Environment, speaking to Liam Cochrane. The well-known Australian cricketer Brett Lee has launched a new music therapy academy in Delhi that is being supported by his charity foundation, Music. The project will train Indian musicians to make a difference in the lives of children affected by trauma, illness, autism, and other challenges. Murali Krishna has the story from India.
Children at the National Centre for Autism, located in Jasola, Bihar, in the outer suburbs of Delhi, had a fair inkling that a special guest was arriving in their midst. Their music instructors were trying to get them to practice more. It was not long before Australian cricket star Brett Lee walked in, this time donning the mantle of a healer when he inaugurated his Music Therapy Academy as one of the core initiatives of his charity foundation. Brett Lee instituted the foundation in 2011 to help the sick with music therapy, following in the footsteps of his senior mate and former Australian captain, Steve Waugh, whose foundation supports underprivileged children and the girl child in the eastern state of West Bengal. Known by his nickname, Benga, Lee's foundation targets the underprivileged section of the society.
We're teaming up to give autistic children, you know, a better chance in life. You know, the empowerment of healing. So, you know, the Music Therapy Academy, it's going to be amazing, and I'm glad I went down there and cut the ribbon today, and hopefully a lot of people are going to benefit from it.
The fast bowler, an eager amateur musician, did not sing, but decided to be part of children from a local orphanage banging the drums. The academy, set up in partnership with a UK-based non-profit organisation, Music Therapy Trust, will train Indian musicians to make a difference in the lives of children affected by trauma, illness or multiple psychosocial or cognitive challenges by offering an international postgraduate diploma in clinical music therapy. Margaret Lobo, who has been associated with this venture, believes this is a good step forward.
I definitely think it'll be a beneficial one because music therapy is something that is really required. For instance, just for people with autism, along with other therapies, music therapy can play a very important role. And we really do not have trained music therapists in India. And it'll help create this entire group of people that we need in the country.
Most people with autism in India have not been diagnosed and, more critically, do not receive the services they need. Besides, there is no data available to provide an India-specific estimate of the prevalence. But figures released by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention place the prevalence of autism in the U.S. at approximately 1 in 88 children. Music therapist and lecturer Dr. Lucan Magal, who moved to India from the United States to head up the academy and train students, believes there is a difference in the methods being used in India.
What we do is different than the traditional therapies, the traditional use of music and healing, though, because what we do is it's a very personalized approach, and we use music that is very specifically designed to meet whatever individual needs are.
Research evidence indicates that music and its elements, when applied as a creative form of expression and communication with special needs children, improves their gross and fine motor skills, aids in academic achievement, improves social interaction skills, and helps with communication and cognitive development. Somesh Porai, a music instructor, vouches for that.
We work with autistic children, we work with cerebral palsy children, people with mental illnesses or intellectual impairments. So this all range of disabilities we work with, and there are results, definitely.
Lee's India-based foundation has spent more than $75,000 in just 12 months, funding a two-year postgraduate teaching diploma in music therapy and therapy sessions for disadvantaged and trauma-affected students and people with autism.
Well, there's many of you listening right now that on a Friday night like to go out and have a beer or two. Well, beer, by the way, has become the world's most consumed alcoholic drink. Now, in Asia, microbrewing is taking off just like in many parts of the world, and it's catching up with beer fans the world over. Recently, Rania Zaidan attended a microbrewery conference or convention or drink up or whatever you want to call it in Hong Kong and filed this report on how the excitement of beer is getting people really interested in microbreweries.
I love beer, I love craft beer, and it's very hard to find in Hong Kong.
For many Hong Kongers, this is the first taste of what's become a global craft beer movement. And visitors at Hong Kong's first ever beer festival were spoiled for choice, with more than 90 types of lagers and ales on offer. The beers are from microbreweries around the world, all dedicated to changing the drinking palate of Hong Kongers. Craft brewing is a return to grassroots beer making by experimenting with recipes and the brewing process. Beer enthusiasts like John So say that flavours are more robust and more interesting. He started the Beertopia Festival to educate people in Hong Kong about the variety of craft beers on offer.
I hope it grows. I hope it helps the awareness of craft beer in Hong Kong and, you know, grows the industry. I think that that starts with awareness and education. And, you know, I think the festival is a great forum for that. You know, it gives people an opportunity to see the breadth and quality available already in Hong Kong.
Until now, major breweries like Carlsberg and San Miguel have had a tight rein on Hong Kong's market.
I think the craft brewing movement is all about just breaking free from what people normally think of when they look at bigger beers. It's people who brew with fun, with creativity. Almost every brewer that I've met is a foodie. They love food inside and out. They love wine. They love great spirits. They love great beer. They're chemists. They're artists.
China, it seems, has long been home to the brewing phenomenon. Archaeologists claim to have discovered evidence of an early beer recipe in 9,000-year-old pottery jars dug up from a Stone Age village in northern China. That recipe has now been recreated by American microbrewery Dogfish Head.
I think it's fantastic. It speaks to the creativity of craft beer and the spirit of craft beer. When you have a story to tell, you know, about the beer, when, you know, you learn that it's not just regular ingredients, it's not just a generic lager. I think that people find that interesting.
And this is just the most spectacular event.
Airline pilot Pierre Cadaret is one of the new breed of Hong Kong craft brewers. He was so fed up with the limited beer variety in the territory that he decided to start brewing his own English-style real ale. His brew is now available in selected bars and pubs around the city.
Essentially, it was actually quite easy. I found the local governmental bodies were very, very helpful, and the rest of it was just sourcing the ingredients and all the equipment and additional stuff back in the UK, just really deciding at what sort of size I was going to pitch the whole venture.
4 years ago, the government in Hong Kong scrapped taxes on drinks with an alcohol content less than 30%. And as a result, wine became incredibly cheap and readily available. Now, craft brewers are hoping to benefit from this tax break and see it as an opportunity to tap into a growing market. There are still only a handful of microbreweries in Hong Kong, but neighbouring countries like Japan are home to more than 200.
I totally think Hong Kong and the rest of Asia is a new market. It's already sprung up in a few countries. Japan has had a craft brewing movement for about the last 15, 20 years or so, and it's slowly getting into the rest of Asia too.
But it seems there's no perfect recipe for cracking the market. In the world of microbrewing, success really can come down to word of mouth.
The small brewers pour the money into the ingredients, they do guerrilla marketing, they work with individual distributors, and they put their money to ensure that they can make the best product possible. And I think that's the key difference. Less marketing, more liquid awesomeness, as I say.
It's that liquid awesomeness that microbrewers hope proves contagious in Hong Kong.
If Chanel had a microbrewery in Hong Kong, or Gucci, I'm almost certain that the Hong Kong elites would take to it. But I think there's enough people who enjoy a drink here in Hong Kong that there's room for virtually anything.
Well, listening to that makes me want to go out and have a drink right now. It's morning, though, so I think I'll have to wait till evening. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. A special thank you to our technical wizard, Susan Lee. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. So until next time, friends, so long and take care.